Well, good morning, everybody. It is really, truly an honor for me to be here today and to be part of this presentation with my esteemed colleagues, who I've gotten to know quite well over the last year and a couple of years in a number of different ways. The think tank for me, I've been able to participate now for the last 2.5 years or so, 2 years, we're coming into our third year, and it really, for me, I've learned an extraordinary model for how you take a federal agency and you take that federal agency's special interest population liaison and you take community-based stakeholders from around the country and come together to bilaterally actually educate staff at CDC as well as bring valuable resources and connections and linkages to broad constituencies in Indian country. And so through this process of helping develop the strategic plan, we have encountered a number of different areas in which we certainly feel as though we can make a difference and be active. And I think it is indeed the optimism of this group that I think really helps keep us going and motivated in this area. So it has really been a pleasure. My job today, my part of the presentation, is to really focus on context, historical context in particular. We each have a relatively short period of time, so it's kind of hard to cram 250 years or so of historical context into 20 minutes, but I'm going to do my best. It's going to be for you as if you were in some sort of time machine that's going to travel back. And why is context so important? Context is really understanding where we are, and it's very difficult to understand where we are without understanding that historical context. My assumption is, without taking too much time into who's here today, my assumption is that, and knowing some people, that some of you may work with tribes and maybe are very experienced in working with tribal communities or are from tribal communities, and therefore some of what I'll be going through certainly may be very repetitious for you. On the other hand, as a particular policy lens, U.S. Official policy lens, that I'm going to be kind of guiding you through this particular context. And context is important, and it only takes a moment to think a little bit about a context example where you may, with your family, year after year after year, get ready to go on vacation. Maybe it's the same time every year. Maybe you do the same thing every year. Maybe you go to different places. But you're used to figuring out where that place is, and you're used to packing up what you want to take with you, and you're used to packing up the car and getting everybody in the car and excitedly begin to program whatever navigation system that you choose to use, only to discover you're going to Hawaii this year. Well, suddenly nothing makes sense, because what you packed and the fact that obviously if you drive to Hawaii, you probably won't survive. So the whole understanding of the context of how you got to where you are, and now suddenly things have changed. And that's the repeated history of the American Indian population in the United States, which I think I've been reading this book called 1491. If anyone ever is interested in that particular book, it's a really good read. But certainly what I've been learning is the extraordinary number of indigenous populations that have been in the Western Hemisphere for centuries and centuries and centuries, thousands of years. So we really are, when we're talking about this historical context, we're really only talking about the last 200 years or so. Okay, where are we here? Oh, there we go. Okay, so again, my purpose really is to examine the relationship between historical and persistent regulatory control of traditional environments and place as a social determinant of health in the American Indian population. And indeed, the think tank and our focus today is really on a place, lands owned by Indian people, which drastically changed as time went on. So the concept of place and its significance of concept of place is something that is part of the context today and that we need to understand. Land is inherent to Indian people. They often cannot conceive of life without it. They are a part of it, and it's part of them. It is their mother. And this is a theme, of course, that if you don't already know, is repeated over and over again, and especially as we go. I think you'll both be talking about that, as well as when we go back to the video, you will hear more about that as well. And that, of course, is the context that is so critical in understanding why it's very the history and the context of official U.S. policy is so important to understand. The rest of my presentation really is taken from this particular book, The Rights of Indians and Tribes by Stephen Pevar. And I think as I've done my research on Mr. Pevar, he has been an attorney in working in U.S. in Native relations for years and years and years. In fact, he spent his first 7 or 8 years on the Rosebud Sioux Indian Reservation as he was kind of learning his trade. But he has become kind of a go-to person in terms of U.S. law and foreign policy. Okay. What we have here is a map. It's a map from the 1800s. And the different colors, it doesn't necessarily matter at this point who, but the different colors represent the various territories that Indians occupied at the time of at about 1800. So we know that there are many tribes and reservations and Indian people that live in the United States Southwest, yet it's blank. Does anybody want to tell me why that might be the case? On this map? Yes.
Because it wasn't settled by white people yet.
Correct. It was, well, there were white people there, but they were the Spanish. Right. Exactly. So, right. So it was not part of the United States at that point in time. And indeed, there are, I think, our oldest continuous indigenous population, of course, resides in the Southwest region that were never actually moved from their traditional lands. Okay, so that represents the vast territories of Indian populations. So here's what we have today. So automatically you can see a very distinct difference between Indian-occupied lands, lands that Indian people viewed as their mother, lands that were sacred, lands that were home, lands that represented subsistence living, lands that provided resources and food supplies to Indian people and their way of life. Certainly, as you can see from this map, has drastically changed in just a few short years. Here's a brief snapshot of how we of some important things, again, to understand in the context of American Indian people today. And again, this is just a snapshot because I don't have much time. In the U.S., in the 2010 population in the census, there were 5.2 million American Indian alone or in combination counted. That's up to about 2% of the overall United States population. And it is also important to know that of all populations in the United States, the American Indian population grew by the largest percentage in this last census. There are 566 federally recognized Indian tribes and nations. They're considered by many the most disadvantaged in our society. There are 80% unemployment on some of the reservations. 14% reservation homes continue to not have electricity, and 12% of homes do not have access to safe water supply. There have been huge gains made, of course, in the last century around these issues, but it's just important to note that there are continued to be some infrastructure issues in Indian country. An overwhelming problem that reservation Indians face today is the confusing pattern of federal laws that regulate so many of their activities. No other ethnic group is so heavily regulated. And so when we get asked the question, I certainly do oftentimes, and I get challenged oftentimes, well, the American Indian population is a small population. We have other minority populations. Well, then we get into the discussion that the American Indian population is not just another minority population. There are unique characteristics about this population, both historically and a number of reasons that make it very different. And one of those reasons, and again, we're talking about context here, is that there are no other ethnic group that is so heavily regulated. So let's go through a journey of what that regulation has looked like over the course of the last 150 years or so. So I'm going to go through this rather quickly. There are a lot of pieces on these slides. If you know something about doing PowerPoints, you're not supposed to do that, but I did it anyway. But again, we're in a time capsule, and we're going to speed through U.S. history and U.S. policy. So initially, as of particularly toward the late 1700s, and in 1700, there were peaceful a rather peaceful introduction to the Europeans, but quickly viewed Indians as heathens and savages and therefore had a right to their land. There were multiple wars and skirmishes between Indians and settlers. It was about the 1700s that diseases introduced by the Europeans to the continent began to decimate the Indian population. And I don't have the exact numbers here, but many of you maybe have read about or know about the extreme decimation of the population, which, by the way, has been the case among all indigenous populations upon colonization. So that's not necessarily unique, but it is part of this context. In 1763, there were the French and Indian War, and the Indians sided with the settlers. This is an example where I think in these earlier years of U.S. history, I think Indians were many times used in those days to recruit to be on one side or the other, because as the U.S. colonists fought the, whether it was the British or the French or perhaps others that were trying to vie for these territories, oftentimes Native communities in those areas were recruited to help fight. So they were considered partners in many ways in some of those circumstances. U.S. founders regarded Indian tribes as having both the right at this time, now we're looking at 1787, about the time of the writing of our Constitution, regarded Indian tribes as having both the right and ability to govern their people as sovereign nations, to make treaties and declare war. And it, certainly in the early years after the Revolutionary War, the U.S. didn't have the energy nor the resources to do anything but basically leave American Indians alone. There it was, the U.S. was weakened in trying to get their new government started, so Indian people were not necessarily an issue at that point in time. 1789, though, the Northwest Ordinance, good faith toward Indians, land will never be taken without consent. Hang on to that thought, by the way, because obviously that's, well, we'll keep going. 1793, Congress prohibited non-Indians from settling on Indian lands. Again, we see a little hint of some protections there. 1801 to 1809, Thomas Jefferson, while friendly to Indians, actively encouraged westward expansion and the removal of tribes. Here we're beginning to see a little notion that once Europeans wanted to begin to move west, white settlers began to take Indian lands illegally. It was not legal at that point in time. Period of 1828 to 1887, this is called the period of Indian relocation. When President Andrew Jackson publicly acknowledged the goal to remove eastern Indian tribes to the west. Okay, now we're beginning to see official U.S. policy emerge that is basically removing Indians from their homeland, from their sacred place. Became the dominant federal Indian policy of the 19th century. In 1830, officially was the Indian Removal Act. In 1832 and 1843, most eastern tribes were removed to the west or placed on smaller reservations in the east. And of course, many of you, in terms of history, are familiar with the Trail of Tears, a devastating forced march to the Oklahoma Indian Territory, resulting in the deaths of 15,000 people. Between 1848 and 1874, gold discovery in California in the Black Hills. Well, what happened there, this rush of white settlers to the Black Hills. Again, lands were taken illegally at that point in time. But again, there was a subtle shift in terms of formal U.S. policy that permitted that to happen. There was the policy, actual policy of killing buffalo. Well, why were buffalo killed? Anybody know why buffalo were, by policy, killed? Food source, right. So what would happen if the traditional food source was gone? Okay. In 1887, federally established schools. We could spend a lot of time on the history of government schools and Indian people being forced and taken, removed from their homes, going to attend those schools. But again, this is the Indian relocation. So the way of dealing with the Indian population at that time was to move them, okay? It didn't matter so much if they were becoming decimated, but let's just move them so they're not in our way. Okay, the period of 1887 to 1934 now is the period of allotment and assimilation. The subtle shift federal policy of removal and separation no longer working as white settlers wanted now all lands. 1887 was the General Allotment Act, his famous Dawes Act, to extinguish tribal sovereignty, erase reservation boundaries, and force assimilation of Indians into society at large. Tribal lands were divided into allotments. They needed to abandon their communal society, and tribes would dissolve in a generation or two. And of course, that was perfectly fine. That was the purpose. Thousands of impoverished Indians sold their allotments or lost land to foreclosure. At a time in 1887 when 150 million acres were owned, 50 million remained in 1934 when the General Allotment Act was finally repealed. Secretary of the Interior could lease Indian lands to non-Indians, control all funds received from leases, and determine when to distribute those funds to tribes and tribal matters. Again, you begin to see this emergence of extreme regulation over Indian property, Indian lands, Indian traditional areas. Now, it doesn't take long. Part of this, I think, is a translation exercise, because it doesn't take long, wouldn't take long for many of us to think about the fact that if our U.S. policy at one time was, okay, home ownership is a good thing. You can own your own home. It's great. You can purchase, of course, if you can afford it, which is getting more difficult these days. But in any case, for many people, in any case, that's a high ideal that many American people have, is to own your own home. So let's say 30 years from now, it's official U.S. policy, you can't own your own home. So now what do you do with that? How do you live? How do you deal with your residence? And then again, maybe 45 years later, now it's okay to own your own home. So this is the kind of thing that perhaps many of us can identify with. 1934 to 53 is the Indian Reorganization period. And the Miriam Report, which was a study by the Brookings Institute based on visits to 95 Indian reservations, revealed atrocious circumstances and extreme poverty. There arose public criticism of Indian policy at that time, and the restoration of Indian, of tribal independence was favored. So now we're going through another swing from a policy perspective and a regulation perspective back to understanding the need for independence. Federal FDR encouraged a radical change to federal policy, and in 1934, the Hallmark Indian Reorganization Act was passed, and that is to rehabilitate the Indians' economic life and give a chance to develop initiative destroyed by centuries of oppression, or century of oppression and paternalism. And it ended land allotment, and something called Indian preference was implemented by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. All right, so now we've gone from a period where independence was favored to a period called termination, 1953 to 1968. 1949, the Hoover Commission issued a report recommending the complete integration of Indians into white society in order to save money by ending federal Indian programs. Okay, so that again, that is key. So what happened in the termination era, this new policy called termination, where Congress terminated its trust relationship with 109 tribes. Now, if you go back to one of my first slides, we talked about 566 currently today federally recognized tribes. At that time, 109 of those were just announced that you were terminated, and you did not have a relationship with the federal government, therefore, we don't have a trust responsibility toward you, therefore, we will not provide any financial resources. At that time in 1956, there was more of a relocation to urban areas to try again, once again, to assimilate. If we can assimilate Indian people, we can help make them invisible. And if we can help make them invisible, then the government resources won't have to go to pay. Where are we today? 1968 to the present is a period of self-determination. And here you can kind of see over the last, and it turns out to be about 45 years, where there's a swing back toward the concept that Indian people should be sovereign nations, that there is, in that time period, there was a Self-Determination Act passed, and Congress has also very importantly restored terminated tribes. But again, that happened not that long ago. And indeed, we work with many, many people on reservations who experienced that termination era and experienced termination and how painful that was. It was as if you existed, but now you don't. So relevant congressional acts, just to whip through this, you can kind of take a look as I continue to speak. These in this period of self-determination, it is important to see that through the years there have been many policies passed that have been favorable to Indian people. 1994 executive order, and we can see certainly with starting with actually Nixon and Clinton and President Obama, there have been executive orders that have spoken to the needs and rights of Indian tribes. Concepts relevant today, these are my last two slides essentially, and both Jennifer and Ralph are going to be talking about more specifically the role of trust responsibility, sovereignty, and self-determination. Congress, it's important to know, because a lot of people talk about treaties. Well, it's a treaty right. Well, it's important to note from a policy perspective that Congress has had the power and continues to have the power to terminate treaties. And I think finally, this last piece here, that in all treaties and policies that have been developed toward Indian people and Supreme Court decisions that have been handed down, that they all shall remain in place until the federal government decides to use it for another purpose. And I think that is the key, that is the stress factor, the anxiety factor that hangs over the American Indian population today. Okay, very quickly, I want you to take a look here at the compression of years. When you look at the swings, we've been talking about policy swings, from one period of time to another. Indians are in favor, Indians are not in favor. Indians to be terminated, Indians are to be assimilated. And you can see the narrowing of those compression years. So in other words, again, by regulation, Indian people have needed to adjust to policy changes over very short periods of time. And I think that is the context of which we need to look at and examine the ways in which, and look at the incredible activities and efforts and initiatives that are going on in Indian communities all across the country today in order to deal with this issue and continue to survive. That is not me, in case you didn't notice that. But in any case, that is me. So I thank you very much. Do we have time for a question or so? Again, we'll take most questions toward the end, but are there any specific questions you have at this point? Yes. Interesting question. You may first have to define what that is for me. However, knowing what I know about anthropology, you just said a word that probably would get many Indian people going on a very rich discussion because of the history of the way in which anthropology as a study and as a science has intersected with what Indians believe to be their origin stories and their creation stories and that sort of thing.